Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is April 25th, 2019, and this is episode 135. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast. I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Shannon Waters.
Welcome back, Shannon. Scott's off gallivanting in Europe for the next 2 weeks, so we brought you back by popular demand. It actually was quite a few people, like you, I think, more than us.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So today we'll have you talk more about the BC legislature as well as the PEI election results. First up, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics, where you can read Shannon's words every weekday. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free 2-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And before we jump in, we have a correction from Patrick. Scott had said it was the PEI legislature where government sits on the opposite side of every other house, and it's actually Newfoundland. So we know even less about PEI than we thought. If you find something else wrong with the show, you can always email us at podcast@politicoast.ca. So Shannon, let's catch up on the legislature. What's the NDP government been up to in a broad sense for the first half of this session this year?
Yeah, so we're closing in on the end of the spring session. We've got 4 more sitting weeks, I believe, until the legislature breaks for the summer. And it's been fairly busy. I mean, we've been on a constituency break for the past couple of weeks, so no new legislation, no debates on that or anything. But they have been keeping us busy, lots of funding announcements, newsers, a lot of MPs from Ottawa have been out visiting over the past few weeks as we head into the election this fall. So we've had some infrastructure dollars being handed out, other investments being announced. So yeah, I mean, there's always something going on in BC politics, even if the legislature is not sitting.
People were asking about a couple of the bills that have gone through. The LNG was one of the big ones that's already passed. There's not really been any progress since that passed, I guess, has there?
No, I haven't heard really much about LNG at all. I mean, we don't hear a lot when the House is not in session about what's going on with legislation. But yes, the LNG bill, as people have been talking about it, it's actually called the Income Tax Amendment Act, passed just before the House rose for the break. And it's been given royal assent, so everything there is good to go. And I guess at this point, we just wait and see what happens in terms of LNG Canada's sort of progress on its project. And the other question being, that bill sort of passed very dramatically. The Liberals actually managed to get an amendment in there. Former Finance Minister Mike DeYoung proposed that the bill be required to keep a clause from a piece of legislation that it was repealing, which was put in place by the Liberal government. And that clause would require the government to make agreements about LNG, such as with companies like, or coalitions like LNG Canada that are developing LNG. It would require the government to make those details public. So we'll see how that ends up shaking out. The Liberals were very excited about that. The government was not so excited about that. And the Green Caucus refused to participate in that vote.
Well, and I guess the other big piece of legislation that passed that a lot of people, at least in my circles in the civil liberties community, were watching was this anti-SLAPP bill. And we know that passed with some changes. And now we're hearing some news out of Ontario that the bill there, or the law there that faced some controversy, is being appealed all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada in one weird case involving, I think it's a former bureaucrat and a former politician who, I forget who libeled who, but I guess one of them thinks it's in the public interest that they speak out.
Yeah, and I'm not super up on the details of the Ontario cases themselves. I do know that the challenge will be going before Canada's Supreme Court. Also, when So this bill, for those who haven't been paying quite as close attention, was introduced last spring by Attorney General David Eby, who said straight up at the time that it was introduced, I believe, on the 15th of May last year. And Eby said, because we only had 2 weeks left in the session, we're not going to touch this legislation now, but we'll be doing it when we come back in the fall. Then we came back in the fall and nothing happened. And the bill was wiped from the order paper when the legislature was prorogued in the spring. Yeah, so the bill was tweaked slightly. Now, nobody in the Attorney General's office really wanted to talk about the details of this. I asked the premier about it, and he said his take was that the bill was being tweaked so that it would address some issues that Ontario's legislation had been facing. The Attorney General's ministry didn't confirm that specifically, but when the bill was reintroduced, the significant change was that instead of being retroactive and applying to any case that was active at the time that the bill gained royal assent, it's only retroactive until the 15th of May last year. And Eby kind of described that as like a fair warning to any parties that might be considering either bringing a suit that could be considered a slap or challenging anti-slap legislation. So I'm not sure if the Ontario challenge is going to have implications for BC's law. Certainly it could if whatever the statute that's being challenged is like exists here in BC, but that's definitely going to be one to watch, I think. Who knows when the case is actually going to go to trial, though? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it can take quite a while for the Supreme Court to get around to hearing things, but it will be interesting to see, like you say, just what the nuance the Supreme Court comes down with, as well as I'm assuming at some point we're going to start hearing about people who have successfully knocked frivolous lawsuits or slap lawsuits out of court using this new legislation. Although it sounds like the Attorney General's been so tight-lipped, he might not brag about any of those successful cases if they do cross his desk or he does become aware of them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens and, you know, what the first case might be to use this new legislation, because BC has had anti-slap legislation very briefly in the past. I believe it was introduced by former NDP government just like shortly before the Liberals took power in 2001. And one of the first things they did was got rid of the legislation. So I don't think there was like the law was ever used previously. So it'll be interesting to see what the first test cases might be like for this new law.
Well, and then on the other side of the civil liberties fence, the NDP's introduced a couple other bills that have raised some ire. We've talked about the civil forfeiture proposals before on this podcast with BCCLA staff. There's also this community safety amendment that sounds like it's, I think it's the bill that's pitched as the Let's Tackle Crack Houses bill. But I know there's some criticism of that as going a bit too far again in this, like, throw the cops at everything and not really solve systemic issues in the way that maybe the NDP supporters might have hoped for.
The phrase that is mostly used, at least sort of within, I believe, the legislation itself, is nuisance properties, a colloquial term occasionally that some people use has been crack houses or whatever, kind of a stigmatizing term, but anyways. And basically, Our public safety minister and Solicitor General Mike Farnworth has seemed to have kind of a similar response to critics of that bill that he has with the civil forfeiture, which is other provinces have measures like this in place. They use legislation like this. And he's also cited the fact that supposedly local governments are supportive of the legislation because it would make it easier for them to deal with properties that are chronically problematic. Neither of the bills have passed yet, the Civil Forfeiture Amendment Act or the Community Safety Amendment Act. They're both going to be going to committee stage over the next couple weeks. It's the phase at which legislation gets sort of the most substantial debate, and the minister responsible can be questioned by members of the opposition about provisions that are in the bill and specific language and things like that. So I think we'll see a lot more of some of the concerns around that legislation come out in the House in the next couple of weeks.
Well, you said it was going to be a busy next couple weeks coming up, probably, and there's two bills that are going to have to be going through committee. I was looking as well at the progress of bills, and there's a lot of other big-ticket items from the NDP's platform and things they've announced, these agricultural land reform changes, these changes to ticket sales and the bots. The zero emission vehicle bill is still on the order paper, and there's another labor reform bill in there. And that's not even getting into ones they haven't introduced, like the proposed reconcile all BC laws with UNDRIP, United Nations Declaration of Rights on Indigenous People, and probably some larger labor reforms. I guess that's what they're going to be up to over the next few weeks.
Yeah, so most of the legislation that has been introduced this spring session hasn't actually passed yet. The majority of bills are actually have only gone through second reading, and many of them haven't even made it that far at this point in time. So there's quite a bit of legislation to get through. It has been suggested to me that we might have a third, so-called third house open up next week, which would mean that MLAs could debate legislation in the chamber, in the Douglas Fir room, and in another committee room somewhere, and it just kind of lets them sort of speed up the process. So we'll see what happens there. We are expecting a piece of legislation to deal with overhauling the labor code and the Employment Standards Act. That's one of the major pieces that's coming. And the premier had mentioned, you know, that his government is working on finding a way to enact UNDRIP through legislation. It now sounds like that piece is going to wait until the fall, which to me makes a lot of sense. It's got to be a complicated piece of legislation. There's a lot of consultation going on with First Nations groups in the province. I think that one will probably not show up until the House comes back in the fall, but you never know. I remember last spring, which was my first time covering a spring session, my first spring in the House, and I was pretty amazed at how quickly they managed to sort of plow through the bills that were left on the order paper in the last few weeks of the session.
Outside the House hasn't been as easy for the NDP either. One of the stories that sort of connects your past working up north and, I guess, Indigenous consultation in a way is this controversy that's erupted that neither Scott or I have really been able to wrap our heads around because I guess we're ignorant city dwellers, is this Northern Cariboo conflict where I guess the federal government has asked BC to reevaluate how we're managing the Cariboo population up north. And it sounds like the premier did good work in consulting with Indigenous people, but he forgot to consult the other people who live in the north and kind of just ran into a massive controversy over this.
The Cariboo consultation situation has definitely been a tense one. It's one of those issues that kind of shows up a bit of this urban-rural divide that we sometimes talk about in BC. And for the NDP, as was pointed out sort of fairly early on in this Cariboo consultation, they have very few MLAs in northern BC. So it's sort of a liberal stronghold. The majority of northern ridings are held and have for a long time, in most cases, been held by liberal MLAs. But this has been a long-running issue in BC. Cariboo were declared at least threatened, if not endangered, in the early aughts. And that sort of triggered, you know, some concerns from government and First Nations, people concerned about the environment. And then I believe it was in 2012, the federal government said to BC, you need to figure out a way to put a plan in place to help Cariboo recover, to preserve their numbers, to stop them from going extinct. The federal government has powers where it can basically declare an emergency order to protect species that are on the brink of extinction, and it gives them sort of broad sweeping powers to essentially close down both recreational and industrial activity in habitat that is critical for whatever the endangered species happen to be. And so in 2018, the federal government took a look at what BC had been doing to, or rather prior to 2018, Ottawa was evaluating what BC had been doing to preserve Cariboo. And in 2018, they came out and said, what you've done isn't good enough. Figure this out, or, you know, we could go with these emergency powers, which would not be good for industry in northern BC. So the province and two First Nations in northern BC began a consultation process to sort of try and develop these recovery plans. And they were unveiled to the broader public several weeks ago. And there was sort of an immediate outcry in northern BC, a lot of frustration from local governments that they hadn't had access to the documents, to the proposals prior to, you know, the province kind of announcing that they were going to do this consultation phase with northern BC communities. Now, to sort of, I guess, give the premier his due, he responded to the, I believe he described it as acrimonious, or trying to dial down the acrimony, by appointing a former Liberal cabinet minister who now happens to be a councillor in Dawson Creek, Blair Lextrom, to sort of act as a liaison in the north and help facilitate these conversations, which have been very tense, and make sure that the residents of northern BC are heard when it comes to their concerns about the impact that trying to save caribou could have.
Yeah, Horgan gets a lot of credit for not the initial bit, but sort of the follow-up. Keith Baldry had a column that I was reading talking about this decision to not just change course on this caribou approach, but for Horgan to actually fly to the north to talk in the communities, to appoint Blair Lextrom, someone he'd yelled at across the aisle, I'm sure, and really just try to make amends for it. And that's a pretty solid response for someone who probably didn't want to walk into this controversy in the first place.
One of the Northern BC MLAs is Mike Bernier, formerly education minister. And he and another one of the Northern Liberal MLAs, Dan Davies, along with former forest minister, also Liberal MLA, John Rustad, they had a group of local government officials from Northern BC come down to visit the legislature shortly before we rose for this constituency break. And they presented a petition that was signed by like more than 30,000 people, wanting the government to stop the current consultation process and sort of engage in what they felt would be more sort of real consultation with people. I think the fear, as I understand it anyways, the sort of fear and the anger that a lot of people in northern BC have been expressing is generated by the fact that they kind of feel like the consultation is just paying lip service to their concerns, and that Ottawa and BC plan to move ahead with these proposals regardless of, you know, what local people have to say about them now. I think that's kind of a valid concern. On the other hand, if Ottawa decides to, like, there's a lot of concern about job loss, about, you know, not having a lot more industrial development go on in parts of northern BC that are sensitive caribou habitat. On the other hand, if Ottawa gets frustrated with BC's approach and decides to just go with an emergency order, that could kill a lot of jobs and essentially put a moratorium on industry in parts of northern BC. But what one of the individuals who came down to the legislature said is that given sort of the lack of specifics that are being discussed with the public and with stakeholders at this point in time in northern BC, they would almost rather that the federal government just come in and impose an emergency order, because then they'd know what was going on. Mm. And that sentiment was expressed before Premier Horgan went and appointed Blair Lextrom and, you know, sort of said, we came at this the wrong way and we want to make sure that, you know, this consultation is meaningful and it takes into account people's concerns. But I think having those individuals come to the legislature and present this like huge stack of paper with all these signatures on it kind of brought home the fact that there are a lot of people in northern BC who were really upset with the way that the province was handling things. And I think to his credit, Horgan seems to have taken that seriously and rejigged the government's approach based on those objections.
That's fascinating. Thanks for the summary of that. And we'll have to keep watching. No, it's important.
Makes sense. And yeah. I'm by no means an expert on this. I have maybe a little bit more experience with than your average sort of journalist in Victoria, because I did spend some time up in Prince George. But it's complicated. There's a lot of factors at play. There's a lot of really intense feelings around the issue. It's going to be a tricky program or issue for the government to navigate at this point in time, I think.
Indeed. I want to run through a couple more things on BC before we move out of the province. These can all be a bit quicker, but while we're talking about tricky, complicated things, I was really fascinated by this report that came out of the chief public health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, I think this was yesterday or today, on essentially calling for the province to take steps to de facto decriminalize all drugs in the province. It's this recognition, I guess, that the public health crisis we're in with the overdose and fentanyl and opioid addictions, the traditional approaches aren't working. And she interestingly sets out two approaches the province could do to essentially stop charging people for minor possession and instead treat this as a broader health crisis that it is. Can you outline those two approaches that she recommended?
It was very interesting to me to see our provincial health officer standing up and essentially saying, like, here are ways that the province could decriminalize drugs from like a legislative perspective. Basically, both of the provisions have to do with the Police Act, which defines how the province interacts with its police forces. Not only does she kind of make the case and say, like, we are never going to fix the overdose crisis if we are still putting people in jail for nonviolent drug possession. So she takes a look at the legislation and basically says, I recognize that BC can't really decriminalize or legalize illicit substances on its own, but here is an approach that would have a very similar effect. So one of the things that the Police Act does is it lets the public safety minister set the province's priorities when it comes to how police officers handle people who use drugs. And what the province could do is declare that what they want police officers to take is sort of a public health and harm reduction approach to dealing with people who use drugs and are, you know, not violent, not trafficking, that kind of thing. And it would basically say, you know, don't arrest them, connect them with treatment options. We don't want to put them in the criminal justice system. The other option would be adding a new regulation that would actually prevent police officers from expending sort of any resources on enforcing simple possession, which is something that's honestly some police forces are already doing. The Victoria police chief was in the provincial health officer's announcement and he said, I dedicate zero resources to minor drug possession.
I found that really fascinating.
I believe the Vancouver Police Department takes a similar approach. The Abbotsford police chief is also on board with this, saying, you know, it's kind of a waste of our time and it doesn't fix the problem. Arresting someone for simple drug possession and having them, you know, in jail for a period of time and then just putting them right back on the street does nothing for dealing with the chronic health condition that they have that is addiction.
But unfortunately, it sounded like Mike Farnworth was not too receptive to the broader suggestion of Dr. Henry.
No, really not, which I kind of find disappointing because it feels like passing the buck. He's basically saying we can't decriminalize illicit substances or federal jurisdiction, and there's no point in us doing anything unless the feds are on board, which the federal government has also said we are not interested in legalizing anything else at this point in time or decriminalizing, et cetera, et cetera.
Which is also fascinating given I think it was at the last Liberal Party convention where the members there passed a motion supporting this kind of approach, a more Portugal style, let's stop going after people who are using and offer a more public health approach. So this consensus is kind of growing out there in some corners. But the upper echelon of the political will is just not there at all, it seems like.
No, not at this point in time. I found it really interesting. Dr. Henry's report mentions like multiple jurisdictions that are either in the process of decriminalizing or have already decriminalized to a certain degree. Everybody talks about Portugal all the time, but the Czech Republic was one of the examples that she held up of a regime that has, you know, sort of decriminalized personal possession and personal use of illicit substances. The key to successful decriminalization tends to be, and this is kind of where the policing aspect comes in, redirecting the resources that are used to enforce, you know, drug policy and redirecting them to like treatment and social support options. That's why Portugal is sort of held up as the prime example, because not only did they decriminalize, but they did sort of overhaul and dedicate a lot of resources to providing treatment options for people. And it seems to have been very successful. And according to Dr. Henry, BC is seeing sort of a similar situation in terms of just the enormous scope of the toll of the overdose crisis at this point in time. There's a recent poll that suggested that 1 in 5 British Columbians has been personally affected by the overdose crisis. And it's been going on for years now. I mean, it was Dr. Henry's predecessor who declared a public health emergency in BC due to the overdose crisis. That was back in 2016. I remember when that announcement was made. I was still at BCIT doing my journalism diploma. And back then, it felt really significant and kind of scary to have that declaration being made. And here we are 3 years later, thousands more people have died, and nobody at any level of government seems to really have the stomach to say, enough is enough. It's time to stop treating addiction like a crime and start treating it in its entirety, like completely like a chronic disease and a public health issue.
Well, let's just close off BC with two more quick questions. We talked earlier this year a lot about this LAMCI meeting and the ongoing spending scandal and all of the reports coming out of the Speaker's office and the competing narratives with the clerk and sergeant at arms. Yet that's kind of all gone dead in the last couple months, at least, or few weeks, at least publicly in the debate. All those fireworks are gone. I guess we have a few, I think there's 5 or 6, I heard, in the House trying to count up the number of investigations ongoing. Are we basically just waiting for those results to come out?
Kind of. I think what really sort of put the stopper in the bottle of what seemed to be almost a nonstop parade of just allegations and counter allegations and all of this back and forth between, you know, the Speaker delivering his reports and the sergeant at arms and the clerk delivering their responses to the reports, and then LAMCI would talk about the whole thing, and it was kind of ridiculous. There were a few ridiculous weeks there. So there are several reviews going on. There is a review of workplace culture and policy. The Auditor General is taking a look at everybody's books. And the Speaker has talked about potentially he's still working on a report around further allegations of like mistreatment of employees. Haven't heard a lot about that recently. But the big one, and the one that's likely to yield a resolution the soonest, is the appointment of former Canadian Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin to look into whether or not the clerk and the sergeant at arms, I believe the terms are around misconduct as employees, like whether they sort of breached the terms of their employment and could potentially then be fired, because the two of them are still on administrative leave. They're still getting paid. And it's been about 6 months now. And that kind of threw a bunch of cold water on all of this back and forth and sort of the media frenzy around, well, what's coming next, and what are the next allegations going to be, or the next sort of counter report. So the report from the former Chief Justice is due, I believe, on the 3rd of May. I'm not sure when that information might become public. LAMCI does have a meeting, I believe. They probably have one in May. They definitely have one in June. And I know that because it's scheduled for my birthday. So at this point in time, yeah, no new developments for a while now, at least none that are being discussed publicly. And we're basically waiting on the Chief Justice to tell the LAMCI, the Legislative Assembly Management Committee, whether or not the clerk and the sergeant at arms were in the wrong in terms of what they did and whether there are any issues around having them removed from their positions permanently at the legislature.
While we're talking about the Speaker and LAMCI, one of the other things they're discussing is the dress code, which you got to be a part of that story. And we did talk about that a little bit, and hopefully you were happy with our coverage of that. But I just wanted to kind of ask you, what is it like as a journalist to be the subject of your own news?
It's kind of uncomfortable, honestly. Like, you know, I'm not typically the subject of stories. I ask people questions. They don't ask me questions. And honestly, like, nobody believes this, but we, the women who came into work wearing short sleeves that day, had no idea that it was going to go the way it went. We were just trying to push back against this kind of arbitrary issue that has reared its head every so often in the legislature, going back decades. And then it all kind of blew up. And I found myself, you know, being interviewed for radio and with cameras in my face. And the other thing I want to say is, like, it was definitely not just me who participated in this. This was not my idea. I did not organize this myself. I was definitely not the only one participating in it. But because of the way both media and government work, so some of the women involved are comm staffers who also work in the building, and they couldn't comment because it's kind of an awkward position to be in where, you know, you're working for the government and also at odds with the legislature dress code and officials and such. And the other issue being that the rest of the women involved were reporters. So they can't cover their own story. Most of them had to hand the story off, or all of them had to hand the story off to others, or just not cover it at all. But the other thing is that corporate media doesn't like having competitors on, you know, the air or screen or whatever. So I was the only one, because I write BC Today and we're an independent, I was the only one who could sort of just talk to everybody and not have that conflict or that sort of competition issue. And so I became the de facto sort of spokesperson. And I just hope that I sort of did the issue justice.
Well, were you happy with the result? Because I think Plekis issued two letters and the second one was much clearer and better than the first. And I think, is there still an ongoing review of that? Or is it kind of settled that everyone can just be grown-ups?
Everyone can just be grown-ups, but they're also doing a review of the dress code. Okay. So everything happened on a Thursday. That's when we came in with short sleeves. And by that afternoon, the speaker had weighed in and sort of said, BC is in line with all the other legislatures in the country, which is just untrue on its face, saying that he would launch this review and we would take a look at the issue. So the review is being conducted by the acting clerk, Kate Ryan Lloyd. And on April Fool's Day, the speaker issued another letter containing Ms. Ryan Lloyd's initial recommendations. And honestly, I looked at it arrive in my inbox. My first thought was that it was some weird April Fool's joke. Anybody who works in the legislature will tell you that nothing happens in less than a week, ever. And it took, it was 4 days, and that included 2 days worth of weekend, you know, for them to make this decision. And Kate Ryan Lloyd basically said, yes, sleeveless attire is appropriate for women to wear in a professional context, including in the legislature. And also that sergeant at arms staff do not need to be enforcing a dress code on anyone in the hallways, which kind of immediately diffused the situation, because that was really the issue, is that sergeant at arms staff were sort of hauling people up in the hallway. And this, it happened to men as well. I believe Richard Zussman was once told that his footwear was inappropriate. There have been some other issues, but it mostly seemed to be happening to women, and it often had to do with sleeves. So we are awaiting sort of the final results of the review, and I don't have a timeline for that, but I'm hopeful that the recommendations will be sort of straightforward, common sense, and just let everybody behave like professional adults and get their work done without worrying about being called out for what they're wearing.
Sounds good. Well, next up, let's go to the other end of the country to talk about the not quite Emerald Isle. The PEI election results were hotly awaited, as perhaps for the first time in the country's history, but PEI was looking set to elect Canada's and North America's first green government, with polls showing the Green Party of PEI in the mid to upper 30s. But it turned out at the end that they didn't quite do so well. The Progressive Conservatives ended up with 36.5% to the Greens 30%. 28.6%, and the Liberals, who were the former government, down to 29.5%. That gives the PCs 12 seats, the Greens 8, and 6 for the Liberals, with one seat to be decided in a by-election following the death of a candidate, which was really tragic. And the Green leader, Peter Bevan-Baker, on his election night speech, really honed in on that death and gave kind of a touching eulogy. It'll be interesting for us here in BC to watch this, because the Green Party here isn't technically affiliated with the Greens out there, but now we have two strong Green movements on coast and coast. Shannon, did you get a chance to talk to Andrew Weaver at all about this election?
I did. We actually had a conversation yesterday. Obviously, the situation is not quite the same as the results that we had here in 2017, where sort of neither of the major parties received a strong mandate. They were within 1%, or I believe even 0.5% of each other in terms of the vote total, which left the Greens, I think, here in BC in somewhat of a stronger position than the Greens in PEI at the moment, but also a historic occasion for the Greens. It's the largest Green caucus that's ever been elected in the country. So even if they're not going to be the government, still sort of another step forward for Green parties in Canada. And I asked Weaver if he sort of had any advice for Peter Bevan-Baker as he approaches, you know, a situation that Weaver might have some perspective on. He essentially suggested that Bevan-Baker go slow and consider his options, not rush into anything, and also suggested that communication is key for minority governments. And so whatever happens going forward will sort of rest on how well whatever parties are involved in whatever governance model comes forward in the province, how well they're able to communicate with each other.
Well, it sounds like PC leader Dennis King is going to be given the opportunity to try to govern by the other two parties. Liberal leader and former Premier Wade McLaughlin, I think, lost his seat in the election, which gives them no real claim to it. The Greens are far enough back that they can't really claim to be the government in waiting, which means we have another conservative government across this country. But it was really interesting hearing the stories come out of PEI, because so many people described it as the most collegial election campaign in that province, probably this country's history. And some of the statements of Dennis King are just like, we're a party that's just slightly right of this very center, and how his party doesn't plan to go after the carbon tax like every other conservative government, it seems like, in this country. And so how they manage to make their minority situation work will be worth following. I went to watch these results with the Vancouver Green Party, had a little election watching party in the West End here in Vancouver. And I asked Adrian Carr, who dropped by after, who's kind of the de facto leader of the Vancouver Greens, what her results were, and I'll throw it over to that interview.
We're ecstatic, of course. Greens across the country are saying woohoo for the Greens in PEI. Well done. It's historic. For the first time, it's looking like we're going to have either a Green opposition, you know, with we don't know if it's 8 or 9 seats yet, but it's the biggest provincial federal caucus ever in the history of this country and probably the continent. They're going to really, really make a difference.
Do they have things to learn from the Vancouver Greens?
Well, we won 9 here, 9 out of 10. And, you know, it's about momentum. You know, I think basically the Greens have the big MO, and you can see it because of people being so concerned around key issues like climate change, like affordability, sustainability, the future for our children. And really, you know, people who are thinking about the future of our children are voting Green. So the lesson to be learned is just that Greens have persisted in developing fantastic policy, and when elected, performing brilliantly, and the PEI caucus is evidence of that.
Do the Vancouver Greens risk losing talented staff to a growing Green movement across the country?
Oh, wow. Well, we only have a part-time staff right now, so we have. Now the Greens in Vancouver from a city council perspective, have hired a staff between us. I have a feeling that we're going to retain our staff, but there are going to be talented people from across the country that are going to be thinking, wow, the chance to work for an opposition, the chance to work for, you know, either it'll either be an opposition or it'll be the supportive party to a minority government as they have here in BC. Coalition governments, I think, are fabulous for democracy. Greens are a fabulous partner, and my hope that they are going to be in the lead partner, the government, with other parties supporting in the future. But I just think, as it is here in Vancouver, without one party in majority, I think that you really get way better decisions. You get fabulous discussion, and you know, better outcomes for the citizens.
And does this show hope for the Greens federally in October?
Of course it does. You look at the progression. So, you know, a year and a half ago now, we had, three Greens elected provincially, forming through a supply and confidence agreement, balance of power to a minority NDP government. In the fall of this past year, you had 9 out of 10 Greens elected in the city of Vancouver. Those 9 out of 10 Greens, between 7 of them, got more votes than any people in the history of school board, park board, and council. I mean, myself and Pete Fry, 20,000 more votes than the mayor each. So, you know, that is so much momentum, and I just think it's just the time. This is, in the history of our planet, our country, our provinces, and our city, it is the time for the Greens.
So the last thing I'll ask you is, PEI is a province bordered by water. Vancouver and Vancouver Island are obviously bordered by water. Does it take that direct connection to the risk of climate change, the flooding, to really drive people to vote green?
Yes, I think that people recognizing that the status quo form of development is actually shortchanging our children and our grandchildren and impoverishing them. And as soon as you get that, you can't vote for the traditional parties and their policies that are so compromised and so sustaining of the status quo. You have to go with a different way of doing business, and the Greens are the lead in a different way of doing business.
All right, thank you, Adrian Carr.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. King seems to be kind of suggesting that, you know, his government may just try and go it sort of alone as a minority and go vote to vote. Out here, Andrew Weaver suggested that's a very risky strategy and could make for another election very soon. But, I mean, it's entirely within King's prerogative to decide to take that approach. And as you pointed out, with sort of the collegial nature of the election and the fact that, you know, PEI is very, very small, it might be easier for a minority government to operate there and to get the support it needs to survive without having to actually have a formal agreement as the NDP and the Greens have out here.
The other thing that came up in PEI is they had a referendum on electoral reform, and the results are being reported largely as they needed to get 50% of the vote and 17 ridings to declare it a win for electoral reform. But as far as I can tell, it was actually, they don't declare a winner unless either yes or no got that high threshold. And in the end, the results were 49% voted for electoral reform, mixed member proportional, and 51% voted against it to keep the status quo, which is bad for electoral reform. But on the other hand, 15 of 27, a majority of the ridings, actually did vote for mixed member proportional. So they have this really unclear result in their referendum. If they use first past the post to decide their electoral system, it would be mixed member proportional now. But if they use a proportional vote, it stays as first past the post. And the Greens sound like they're on the fence about this. They were big supporters before. And I don't think anyone's actually said, we're going to throw this out entirely or we're going to adopt it wholeheartedly. But PEI's had a number of referendums on electoral reform over the years. And the previous one did side with MMP in the end, but it was such a low turnout that the Premier didn't want to adopt it. Maybe it was referendum fatigue at this point for the Islanders. but another blow for electoral reform advocates who were hoping to see at least one province in this country go that way.
I think Quebec is the last province standing with sort of the issue yet to be determined, or potentially yet to be determined. My understanding of the situation in PEI is that given the results, the referendum will not be legally binding on the government, so they can essentially decide to do with it what they will. I have a hard time seeing it coming up again very soon in PEI. I found an interesting story today from the Tyee's Legislative Bureau Chief Andrew McLeod suggesting that Fair Vote, I believe it's Fair Vote BC, and an organization in Nova Scotia that's interested in electoral reform are getting together to launch a constitutional challenge to the first past the post system itself. And so that will be something to kind of keep an eye on. Their argument essentially being that the first past the post system does not fully realize or somehow thwarts kind of the rights of voters in terms of having their votes count, essentially. And that politicians cannot be trusted to act in the interests of voters on this issue, which I think is a very interesting premise.
I've seen the fundraising emails for that challenge, and I'm skeptical, but I love a good legal fight, and so we'll definitely be following it and see where that goes. Maybe we'll get someone from Fair Vote on in the future to try to make the case for why this is the best or last way to go forward. Finally, though, let's move on to a couple quick takes. One of the big stories that jumped out of the Globe and Mail this week was on the judiciary itself. Speaking of the courts, they had a source come forward, a confidential source, tell the Globe and Mail that the Prime Minister's office was using their internal party database, Liberal List, to actually vet judges. The PMO has the ability to appoint and not appoint judges as he will, and he has been using an independent panel to recommend those judges. That panel is using a number of sources that you would expect, like Google, that they haven't been in some controversy, look up some of their past judgments and so forth, make sure they're not a registered sex offender and that kind of thing. The PMO, though, is then taking this extra step to see if what connections they might have to the Liberal Party. And the Globe and Mail went one step further and used public information from Canada's election donor database to find 25% of judges appointed by Trudeau since 2016 have donated to the Liberal Party, compared to 6% who've donated to the Conservatives, New Democrats, or Greens. But of those people who were donors, most of the money that was coming from those judges went to the Liberal Party. So combined, that 289 judges donated 90% of the amount that lawyers who went on to become judges gave to political parties. This is $321,000. It all is a bit dodgy, because the idea of the PMO and judiciary should be very separate from this partisan lens and this engaging in politics. And we saw this kind of come up in that weird allegation leak about Jody Wilson-Raybould recommending one justice be put on the Supreme Court and Trudeau saying, oh, he's too right-wing. It's a good story from the Globe and Mail, and so I'll put a link in the show notes. It's another one that's paywalled, but, you know, you got to pay for the news.
Yes, you do. Or at least, you know, reporters have to pay rent. So yeah. It really helps when people pay us for our work. Yeah, the optics on that certainly don't look good. I would go further than saying it seems a bit dodgy to just, it seems very objectionable to me that the PMO is in any way considering partisan affiliation when it looks at who is being appointed as judges. Like, it's just completely inappropriate as far as I can tell. And there's no reason, there's no justification that I can see for that move.
Well, from the Liberals to the NDP, Jagmeet Singh's having a bit of a moment in the spotlight. He had a book come out this week, which I don't know if I knew was coming, but I guess it's the new thing.
I'm totally surprised by it.
Okay. And it wasn't just that he dropped a book, but it also includes some pretty dark parts of his life where he was very upfront about the fact he was sexually abused. I mean, it's an intense story, and I've just been, in a way, impressed by the amount of coverage this is getting, and just, and not that that's a bad thing, but it's just kind of a, maybe a churn for the NDP? Like, is launching a book the way to get headlines these days?
I don't know. I mean, Singh is the new kid on the block when it comes to federal party leadership, so I can see, you know, maybe thinking that it's a way to introduce him to the public more widely in a way. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know that it's the way to kind of get voters to want to vote for you, but it does sort of open a window into his life. Like you said, he includes a lot of personal details in it, and a way to also, you know, just get more eyeballs and more people recognizing the name. So whether, you know, it will have a net positive effect or whether it might push some people away, who knows at this point, but I put it on my reading list.
See, I personally lean against, just in terms of what I do read, it all tends to be very like hard analysis nonfiction, and the memoirs and fiction in general, not that memoirs are fiction, but those personal stories don't generally appeal to me. Like, I did read Rosemary Brown's memoir recently, but that was more to get an insight into the political life of BC's first Black woman legislator.
Mm.
And so Jagmeet Singh's book, I'm sure, will be interesting, but I don't know. It's just maybe not for me, but enjoy seeing the headlines.
Yeah, and I think it's a valid point that, like, not everybody is going to be like, oh, Jagmeet Singh put out a memoir, I really want to read it. And it might, you know, the people who read it might primarily be people who are already sort of well disposed to him and his party. But like you said, there's headlines and there's a book tour. So, you know, we'll see, I guess, how it goes.
Well, and finally, Shannon, have you been following this Ricochet libel lawsuit?
I read about it today, actually, for the first time.
Yeah, so Ricochet is going to court this week to fight off a Quebec media persona, I guess, who they, Ricochet, published a satirical obituary about. And this is a tradition in French media to satirize the death of someone you dislike. And I guess, in his view, they crossed the line of good sense and good proper journalism and broke the law, and now they have to fight in court this guy's libel lawsuit. And it was mentioned on Canada Land. I want to mention it as well, because this is a serious threat to free speech and journalism. And it's just shocking that it's going this far. I mean, I guess only BC, Ontario, and maybe one other province have an anti-slap law, but this does show how valuable those can be.
Yeah, because the basis of anti-slap laws is sort of protecting the public interest and public participation in discussions around policy and issues that are relevant to people and people living their lives. BC's is actually called, anti-slap law is actually called the Protection of Public Participation Act. And defamation suits can get complicated, and certainly I think media outlets do get challenged from time to time as to whether their, you know, coverage or reporting or what it is that they publish, you know, is accurate, has value, et cetera, et cetera. But having the ability to argue that a lawsuit that's being thrown at you as a media outlet is being done in a malicious way, an unproductive way, is valuable. And yet there's not a lot, as you said, there's not a lot of places in this country that actually sort of protect that aspect, protect public participation.
Well, and Ricochet is one of the few small independent media outlets in Canada, sort of like BC Today. What is the umbrella of BC Today? Is it just Queen's Park Today? How do I refer to Allison's Empire?
So funnily enough, I just filed my taxes, and I mean, I knew this before, but so we incorporated in the fall, now that we have three separate outlets in three separate provinces and a nice little handful of people working for this company, and we are incorporated under Baby Media Mogul. So I don't think that's the umbrella term. We don't really have an umbrella term. But we are a small independent media outlet. Luckily, at least to my knowledge, none of us have been sued for defamation at this point, knock on wood. But I would hope if we were that we, you know, would have the protection or potentially the protection of anti-SLAPP legislation.
Well, I'll throw a link to the Ricochet article that talks about this lawsuit in the show notes, and people can go and check out Andre Margoulet's podcast, Unpacking the News, if they want some leftist analysis and want to hear more about what Ricochet is up to. But otherwise, Shannon, thanks you once again for joining us on Politicoast. How's the cat thread going?
Cat thread is awesome. It was the only thing I missed about Twitter when I took my little break over the long weekend. I was like, there's going to be so many cat photos to check out. I can't believe it's like been about 6 months already.
Well, till many more months of cat photos.
Many, many more.
That's been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe. Let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikov. Thanks for listening.